if we are to look at literature, or maybe in our own experience, we know the course of true love hardly ever runs smooth, does it? I suppose in the nature of film or stories, if you had something where, you know, people fell in love, you know, and everything was fine and then got married, it wouldn't make much of a story, it wouldn't make much of a film. So, you know, if you go the Hollywood route, there's going to be outrageous plot twists. There's going to be all kinds of things that will get in the way. If it's a romantic comedy, there'll be ludicrous situations that happen. But eventually you get there. There'll be a wedding at the end. Well, actually, interestingly enough, we might expect, as we're looking at the Song of Songs, and as I was saying last week, there's a sense in which it's saying, yeah, human love is good, and the physical side of it is good. We might say, well, this is idealized. But the Bible, although a divinely inspired book, I realize it's written for humans, doesn't it? So it always brings in stuff that reflects the human condition. And when we get to chapter 3 of Song of Songs, or Song of Solomon, we see that the course of true love is troubled sometimes. In chapter 3, verse 1, there's a fear, and this is my first point, a fear of losing love. This seems to be almost a dream sequence. As I said, the Hebrew in the Song of Songs is sometimes gives us a clue as to what's going on. In a sense, we're coming back in a minute to the last part of the reading, comes back to where we started in the book, in chapter 1. And then there was a little sort of flashback, it seemed, to courtship days, because the Hebrew is in the past tense. But here there seems to be a dream, something sort of a bit surreal. Some people surmise that she's trying to remember a dream. There was a disturbing, maybe a bit like a nightmare. There's a fear of losing her love, and she wonders where she is. There's a fear of separation. You see that very clearly in the first three verses. There's an almost out of context to the rest of the book, isn't it? She's talking about being in the city. And again, that makes us wonder, doesn't it? We've been used to this pastoral setting, particularly in the first part of the book, where the lovers are so in union. Here, you know, things are out of sync a bit. And she searches in an unfamiliar place for her lover, inquires for him. But then they're reunited. Whether in the dream or whether she wakes up and realizes that her betrothed is still close, because it's interesting, it mentions that she takes him to her mother's house, a place of security. And also, I think, in the context of the poem at this place, a place where they are chaperoned. Because my theory on that is really because what she then says. This curious phrase that appears in the book from time to time. We saw it, I believe, when we're looking at the start of chapter 2, as I was saying last week. It's picking up on chapter 1, the beginning. It's the wedding night, and she's sort of overwhelmed by the emotion of the occasion. And again, we get this warning in 3 verse 5. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field. Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. It's wonderful, the emotion she's feeling as she approaches her wedding night. And indeed, as we're seeing, we'll be going back to in a minute as we get to the centre of the book, she feels on her wedding night, is a wonderful feeling. But she realises there's a rightness of it being in the right place, in the right time, with the right person. As I said last week, the Jews would have seen this because of Jewish culture and the understanding of betrothal. Betrothal was seen very much like a marriage. There was an anticipation of marriage, but it was not the sexual intimacy of marriage. That was in marriage. That's why we read Joseph wanting to put away Mary quietly when he first realizes she's pregnant until he is told it is of God. So there's a fear of losing love. And that reminds us where human emotions are involved. Life's a bit of a roller coaster, isn't it? When we were speaking the other week, we were looking at this for Stony Words feature. I said there was a really odd period in our relationship where I'd asked Tracy out. It's really funny, being a little bit older than her, she was in a youth group in the church, which was just below my age range, so we couldn't really spend much time together. And it's very frustrating because I sort of realised in the end, I'm never going to get to know this woman unless I ask her out. It's just not time. And I asked her out, and being me, I did the unusual thing. I didn't sort of say, right, do you want to come out with me? I want a decision now, this kind of thing. I said, have a think about it for a week. And yeah, there was that sort of situation during the week. What's going to happen? What's going to happen? You know, is she going to sort of think about it? Oh, no. You know, should I just said, oh, no, you know, ask her out, you know, on the spot sort of thing. You know, life's a roller coaster. There's always going to be risks in relationships, aren't there? And that can be difficult. We put our, you know, we wear our heart on the sleeve. We lay it out. And there's the fear of losing love. Secondly, there can be distractions. As I was saying last week, Solomon's place in the book is always heavily debated. When I said I had a slight issues with this, I think this is a brilliant book. If you go on Amazon, you'll see I've given it a 5-star review. But I'd still differ over the role he's given Solomon, which is much more central. Solomon's mentioned several times in the book. And even though he's mentioned several times, he seems to be a passing, particularly here, a passing distraction. It seems to be the woman who's still speaking. She's observing. Some commentators, as I've said, see her as the bride at this point of Solomon. It may be explaining or observing the event that we read about in 1 Kings 3 verse 1. Where Solomon made an alliance with Pharaoh and he is given the daughter of Pharaoh as his wife. It seems to be one of his weddings, and there are a good number of them, if we are to read scripture. And yet it's distracting. It kind of takes her away. This is the one time where she's not mentioning her beloved. Verse 11, after observing all the splendor that we see in verse 6 to 10. It gives a good picture. There's Solomon's carriage, 60 warriors. They're decked out in their best. And his carriage, wood of Lebanon, posts of silver, base of gold. She says, come you out, you daughters of Zion, verse 11, and look at King Solomon wearing the crown. The crown which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day his heart rejoiced. It's interesting, but it's almost, this is what I feel in the poem, it intrudes into the main narrative. So secondly, there are distractions from love and true love. And this is something which I think is important to us, isn't it? Not only in our relationships. One of the wonderful things one of my biggest arguments, as I said last week, for Solomon not being the main character, not being the lover in this, is that he actually had 700 wives and 300 concubines, and I still can't get my head around that. But this person's only got eyes for the woman there. It's not like, I don't think it quite fits with him wanting to add one more to his collection, does it? But it's distracting, isn't it? For the one part here, it's taken away, her focus is taken away from her lover. And we need to be careful with that, don't we, as Christians? so often the world intrudes in. There can be things that are so good. God gives us many good gifts, leisure, time, food, drink, our marriages if we have them, friends, whatever. But they can be a distraction, can't they? There can be a real distraction which takes us away. One of the things I've often said about marriage, I've encountered this in my last church particularly, it was something I was having to constantly deal with, was the issue where young girls in the church were going out with non-Christians. And I was always getting, you know, people saying, well, you know, can you have a word with my daughter about this? Or, and some parents were helpful and some parents weren't very helpful and stuff like that. And the point is this, you know, I actually used to say, look, can you just, I'm going to give you an example. You say it's fine, you know, I can do this, I can go out with this non-Christian, whatever. I said, do you think I could be an effective pastor if Tracy wasn't a Christian? Do you think I can do my job? Do you think a pastor should switch off when he gets home completely from being a pastor? Because it's a vocation, isn't it? You know, it's going to be, well, what are you doing? You know, why are you spending so much time on that sermon? You know, it's not a job. Well, you know, I remember once talking to a fellow pastor, and we both had, I think, frustrating weeks, and we were sort of going through, you know, when's the sermon finished? Well, when it's finished, when it's preached. And, you know, you're never quite sure how much time it's going to take. Sometimes you look at a passage, it comes together relatively quickly. You still do your additional reading because you want to make sure. Other times you've got one of these passages. I can remember when I was doing Ecclesiastes and Ephesians last year, and you just grapple with it for ages, and you know, it's really hard work to get to the centre of the passage and then to explain it. And you find yourself picking it up again late at night. When's the pastoral visit or problem finished? Well, whenever what needs to be resolved is resolved. And my general experience of that is it often takes a long time. You need someone, don't you, if you're a pastor, who's behind you, who agrees with you, who understands what you're doing. And I actually said every member in a church has a part to play. So again, can you be an effective Christian? There's a distraction there, but it's not that Christian couples are not undistracted. There can be the distraction of work, can't there? There can be a distraction of family. You know, the quiet time starts to slip. The time of fellowship starts to go, doesn't it? And the splendour of Solomon makes, as I said, almost an intrusion into the poem at this point. Almost an out of context moment, because next we go back and suddenly we get this devotion again between the two lovers. So fear of losing love, of distractions from love. Then we have the language of love. Communication. I think communication in all relationships is very, very important. And this takes the form here of what is an Arabic love poetry. Apparently, in the ancient Near East, there's been a lot of evidence through archaeological discoveries in Egypt of these forms of poetry. They were called wasifs. And it's only found, this kind of poetry, in the Song of Solomon in the Bible. There are other bits that speak highly of relationships in the Bible, but this kind of language is found here. Jonathan Edwards, who of course was a ministering, I think he's probably one of these guys who's got greatest theological brain sort of on the planet since Calvin or the Apostle Paul. He spoke of when he first met his wife-to-be Sarah. He said this, "When we behold a beautiful body, a lovely proportion, a beautiful harmony of features of the face, delightful airs of countenance, and a voice and sweet motion and gesture, we are charmed by it." Now, I think that's rather interesting, isn't it? I always said the Puritans are good at getting things out in the open. And so he was very much reflecting on the kind of picture we have in chapter 4. The phrase, "How beautiful you are, my darling, oh, how beautiful," has been compared in his commentary on the Greek text by that notable scholar, Tremper Longman, as he said, actually, if you go to the Hebrew, it's got elements of you drive me crazy. It's interesting, the King James, I think, has the phrase, "You have ravished my heart." These are, again, getting back to what, Edward Taylor, the Puritan pastor, said. These are hot emotions. He also used to, as I said, when couples came to him speaking about marriage, he would say, "Do you love each other?" with a Song of Solomon love. Do you have that wow factor? It's an appreciation. It's rather interesting in this description. As I said, if you try and do a literal picture, you're going to run into some problems here. But you kind of let the poetry flow. One thing that is interesting here is that he compliments her and parts of her body seven times. Now, seven times in Jewish thinking is important. It's the complete number, isn't it, in Jewish thinking? It's the number of perfection. He's saying, "You are beautiful. You're so beautiful. It's as if you're almost perfection." And he communicates that. And that's a challenge. You know, husbands here. Have you complimented your wife like this lately? Do you tell her she's beautiful? I'm hoping I have said that to Tracy today. But there's a lesson for all of us here. Do we compliment? Because there is a bit of a danger of time going on. We tend to think, don't we, that sort of we settle in. Some people, the phrase is, you settle into a rut. And okay, here we are on the wedding night. I believe we're very much on the wedding night. But I'm going to make an argument, as I did on the other day, that later in the book, some years on, there's still the passion for each other that there is here. So he is seeing her beauty. He's commenting on that. And the sequence that started way back at the start of the book in chapter 1, 2 to 4, and 2, 3 to 6, where we get this picture of the wedding night, is coming to a conclusion here. If we look at 8 to 11, there's an escalation. It's now come. Be with me. This picture of a sort of metaphorical journey is come together. Again, there's a picture when you get to verse 9. Again, Temporal Longman interprets it as, "You drive me crazy. You have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride." The use of sister is interesting in the book because it's used a couple of times. And it's to do with Jewish culture. It's not that he wishes she was his sister. It is to do with the coyness of Jewish culture. You could kiss your sister in public. It might be frowned on if you kissed your wife. And there's a phrase later where she refers to him wanting to be like a brother to her. And it's basically saying, "I'm just so passionate about you. I want to show my affection and not have it commented on by other people." So there's this picture, isn't there? You drive me crazy. Rather interesting, you've had a picture early on. It's interesting. How funny how things flick into your mind, isn't it? This picture in chapter 4 of how beautiful you are, how beautiful your eyes are like the dust, your hair is like a flock of goats descending from Mount Gilead. She was a Shumanite. She probably had dark hair and the goats are black in that area. But the idea is her letting her hair down. Is it Charlie Rich, that song, "When We Get Behind Closed Doors"? We get a good idea of what's going to go on here, don't we? She's letting her hair down. And she lets her hair down. And she makes me glad that I'm a man. I don't know, it's not particularly a song I like, but I just remember it from my youth. There's a really vivid picture of what's happening here. And what we see is just how wonderful this is. I don't really want to go into it now, but if you're taking notes, it'd be good to look up Proverbs 5, 3 to 6, and 5, 15 to 20, where you get the strange woman whose feet wanders from her door and keeps, who's never around her husband too much, and when her husband's away is out on the prowl. And there's sort of metaphors used here in a positive that are negative there. It's the opposite of there. Here there is security. Here there is a rightness and wholesomeness. And it reminds us of what we were looking at earlier, God's love for his people. Zephaniah 3:17, the Lord your God is with you. He is mighty to save. He will take great delight in you. He will quiet you with his love. He will rejoice over you with singing. The Lord wants to make the church perfect. We were looking at Ephesians 5 last week. She's going to be his bride without stain or wrinkle. And isn't that the picture we have here? And lastly, after the language of love, we have what's termed in many versions the garden of love. When we get to chapter 4 and the end of chapter 4, there's a picture here of her being prepared compared to a garden. And it's interesting, the garden is locked up. Springing's closed, a sealed fountain. And this seems to be a metaphor of the husband referring to his wife's virginity with approval. There's a picture here, isn't it, as we go on, and the language gets spicier and spicier. There's this mention of Hermes. It's a heady mixture of sort of romance and sort of quite a sensual sort of picture being conjured up. As I've said when I was doing Stony Words, particularly towards the end of the book, there's a picture of intimacy, sexual intimacy, out in the open. Away from prying eyes, yes. There's this picture here. And what's interesting is that we see he is commenting, there's a security of marriage, and then there's an invitation. Verse 16. The voice has changed, it's in the feminine. Awake, north wind, come, south wind, blow on my garden, that its fragrances may be spread abroad. Let my lover come into his garden. It's the picture Paul uses. I like Paul's teaching on marriage in 1 Corinthians. It's very earthy. Martin Luther would certainly approve of that. Martin Luther once said that, this was before he married actually, he said he thought priests should have housekeepers and marriage was a good thing because having man and woman under one roof and not expect anything to happen was like having, fire and straw close together and expecting it not to catch light. And there's that picture, isn't there, that where Paul says that the wife's body does not belong to herself, it belongs to her husband, the husband's body belongs to the wife. And that's the picture we've got here, isn't it? Let my lover come into his garden. It's an invitation. It's mutual. And it's accepted, isn't it? Awake here, interesting enough, the word awake, wake north wind, is the same word for awake we've seen when she says, do not awaken desire until it pleases. So she's now saying, right, you can awaken desire. This is the right time. This is the right place. Emotion, and here's an important thing. Emotion is not separate from the physical. The Song of Songs has an emphasis on physical love, but always with an undercurrent and then coming to the fore at important times of emotional attachment. The emotions are all involved. And this is something that unfortunately is being lost in society. People are dividing things. I'm not going to even say young people, because I think that's a cop-out now. People have relationships now based just around sex in some cases. There's a term for it, but it's too crude to use here, so I won't. Emotion is not to be separate. This is wonderful communication, invitation and acceptance of that invitation. Look at chapter 5. I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh and my spice. All these things he's been talking about being in the garden. All the good things there. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk. Rather interestingly, when we look at Genesis chapter 2, verses 23 to 25, that first marriage that we have in the Bible, where it talks about the man and woman being one flesh, or cleave in the King James, the Hebrew means to be stuck together, involved on every level. It's a wonderful picture. Emotions and sexual intimacy are not separate things. The husband's acceptance of his bride's invitation. And at this point, the friends rejoice. Last part of chapter 5. Eat, O friends, and drink. Drink your fill, O lovers. I may have mentioned it last week as well. Puritans were pretty sort of candid about what happened on the wedding night. And apparently, there were wedding songs they used to sing which were pretty explicit about what the bride and groom would be getting up to. And this was because, you see, they rejoiced in the good things. They saw the sexual side of marriage not as sinful, but as a good thing. God had given it as a gift. And as I said, you know, we need to strike the balance. I think the church lost ground in its reaction to the permissiveness of the 60s, which was wrong. Which has continued, obviously. But really it should have been exhorting, not the thou shalt not. Yes, true, it should. But it should have also been saying at the same time, look at what God's manual is for marriage. Look at the goodness of it. Look at the communication that takes place between people. Look at the way that emotions are involved. Look at the way that people are made to be fulfilled or can be when love is selfless. Look at the way it is mutual in its invitation acceptance. It's not, in a sense, a compromise so much. I know we tend to sometimes think of making compromises in marriage, and lovingly perhaps we sometimes have to do that. But it's more about being in tune, isn't it? Communicating. It's a lovely picture. And as we sort of leave these lovers now, husband and wife, marriage fulfilled, it brings us to the picture of God's people being unified with God, doesn't it? We go to the end of the Bible, Revelation chapter 21, verses 2 to 4. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning's crying pain, for the old order of things has passed away. There's another sermon there, but I'm not going to preach it now. Just two things to note. There's a picture, isn't there? Again, it's being picked up. We see it in other parts of the Bible. It's about the church being like a bride. Christ, through his death, having made it without stain or wrinkle. Beautiful. And here's the other picture. A fulfilled people. He, God, will wipe every tear from their eyes. There'll be no more death, no more mourning or crying or pain. For the old order of things has passed away. And that would have been very, very important to the churches that the book of Revelation was written to. I believe it's written to the church in every age. In a sense, it's seven churches, so it's written to the complete church. But these were churches. The churches that have letters being sent to them were going to face persecution. Life wasn't going to be great. Life wasn't going to be fulfilling in many ways. And what does John say? Well, look, I've seen a vision where God's people will be made perfect, where God's people will be with him, and they will be totally fulfilled because he loves them so much. There's the picture, isn't it? There's the picture of the cross. God should judge us for our sin. God is angry at sin. The wrath of God, Romans 1:18. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness. That's the situation. That's how Paul starts that great book of Romans. But the actual picture in the end is this, isn't it? There's a way out. There's a way out through the cross. And through the cross, when we realise our sin, when we seek forgiveness, we can be made perfect and we can be made fulfilled. And even the troubling times, which have been reflected in the Song of Songs, even the troubled times can lead to that complete consummation. If we have an idealised view of love here in the Song of Songs some of the time, we see that it is ultimately found in God, in Jesus, God's love for his people. Let's pray.